Brethren, our next session is a study on Daniel by Brother Bill Dutka from Detroit. Brother Bill and I have had a lot of scriptural discussions. Some of them have been on Daniel. And we're just delighted that he could join us and lead us in this service. Now, we do have a roving mic, and Stephen is going to man that mic. So raise your hand, and he'll be prompt to get his mic to you. And so with that, we'll introduce Brother Bill.
Good afternoon. Well, we wanted to bring the Christian love and greetings to your brethren in the Detroit area. The Wednesday Detroit Ecclesia meeting and the Sunday Metro meeting, those brethren wanted their love conveyed to all of you here. And also my wife, Sister Shana, wasn't able to accompany me, but she wanted her love conveyed to all that are here today. Now, we had a little bit of a pre-ramble we wanted to talk about first before we got right into the book of Daniel. We're going to go from some elementary questions in the book of Daniel to some more deeper questions. So we don't want anybody to lose sight of, you know, like, okay, this is kind of elementary. We're going to get into some deeper things. So we wanted everybody to kind of stay, you know, engaged in our study here. To remember that this is a one-room schoolhouse also. So there's, you know, many different aptitudes that are seated out in the audience here. And the most important thing we can learn from this study is some tools, I think, that we can maybe take home with us when we go deeper into the book of Daniel or look at some of these different prophecies. That's one of the things I want to kind of, you know, convey today is there's maybe some tools that we can learn for additional study. And then the other, my first question here really has to not do with so much the book of Daniel, but I thought I would ask this question. And it's not related to the book of Daniel, but what is one of the main roles of an elder? Can anybody tell me what one of the main roles of an elder is?
Shepherding.
Okay.
Be an example.
Be an example.
Apt to teach.
Apt to teach. Okay. You know, when I look at one of the main roles of an elder, it is to teach the brethren how to think. You know, we can all stand up here and we can have maybe all the answers and everything like that, but there's going to be a day when we're not around. And so somebody else has to take over. And the whole point is cognitive thinking. I think that's, you know, maybe one of our main points as being an elder is to teach the brethren how to think. You know, so many go to college and they get a bachelor's or a master's degree, and you get hired in a job. Does college teach you everything about that job? It gives you certain skills, but one of the main things of an employer is when they hire you is you've got some cognitive thinking. You're able to do some you know, processing and figure out problems. That's I think, some of the skills that you learn. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, make that as a point here as we go through here in our pre-ramble. And then the last one here is, you know, where are we on the stream of time? And I think when we look at the book of Daniel, it should, you know, that's kind of how my mind thinks, you know. How does this book apply to me? And where are we on the stream of time compared to the book of Daniel? So with that, let's ask the first question here. How many chapters are in the book of Daniel? 12 chapters, okay. And how are they divided? See, the first question was really easy. Now we're going to get into a little more depth. How are they divided? Yes, Sister Ruth. Okay, and so history and prophecy, and so what can we say? How, so there's 12 chapters, and how can we divide those 12 chapters?
Six and six.
Six and six. So the first six would be history, and the last six would be prophecy. I see some puzzled faces out there, but hang in there with me, okay? Why are they segregated that way, or why are they divided that way? Okay, so that's the way Daniel wrote them. What can we say about the first six compared to the second six in a time frame or on a timeline? Are they successive? All chapter 1, then 1 through 6, and then 7 through 12, are they all successive like that in a timeline? Brother David.
I would say the first six are sequential, and then the next six are sequential, but the two groups of six do overlap.
Okay, so the first six overlap on top of the next six. So those are some key things to kind of think about when you're like, we're going to go through an overview of the book of Daniel, and then we're going to hit some specific chapters if we, we're going to have time to do that, and then depending on how much time we'll have, we'll get more in-depth on some of these chapters. But we wanted to kind of take a big overview. So as you're looking at the book of Daniel, you've got history and prophecy. The first six are history. The second six, we look at prophecy, and then they overlap on top of each other. Here's just another broad question. If you were asked for one theme that is a thread that reappears throughout the book of Daniel, what would that theme be? And I've already talked to one brother, and he had a different theme than me. So, and he went through his whole thinking on it, so I thought it was interesting. So what would that theme be if you went through the book of Daniel that appears in many different places? And I think there probably is more than one theme. Brother Jim?
I'd say the history of the world.
Okay, the history of the world. Any other themes? God is always in control. Okay. Brother David?
Frank Chalous used to say that Daniel really is a kind of a picture of the church. Somebody mentioned Joseph, Brother Darius did. And Joseph we often think of as a picture of Jesus. Joseph and Daniel had a lot in common. But if you look at it, Joseph is a picture of Jesus' experiences and Daniel, the correlating experiences of the church. That's not a theme, but that's a kind of a symbolic picture. I didn't get that point until I read it from Brother Frank, but I think he's right.
Okay. Brother Brad? So Brother David says that, Daniel would be a picture of the church. And we're going to actually talk about that in a minute, too. Brother Brad?
Yeah, I was noticing going through Daniel, preparing for this, that there are three places where it says that Daniel was a man after God's heart, or that he was greatly beloved of God. And I looked at Daniel's responses to some of the things that he encountered. For example, not destroying the wise men of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to destroy them, and Daniel actually stood up for them. So there are character attributes that we notice that when we go through the book, we see those character traits in Daniel's behavior, and I think they lead to him being a man greatly beloved of God.
Okay. And I'll tell you what mine was. Anybody else have a thought here? God's everlasting kingdom. It's mentioned a number of times in Daniel. Daniel 2:44, Daniel 4:34, Daniel 6:26, Daniel 7:13-14. And then if you look at the 1,335 years brings you to certain points and different things that they were looking for. So it's that, I think there's that underlining theme or a thread that kind of weaves through the book of Daniel that would be, the kingdom, that aspect of it. Yes?
Which is why it's important to have history first before prophecy, because you have to understand some history before you can see how the prophecy is woven.
Okay. Now, if we were to spend an equal amount of time on each one of these chapters, I have about 75 minutes, less than that now, divided by the 12 chapters, that gives us about 6 minutes and 15 seconds for each chapter, which that's not what we're going to do. It's just not enough time to do any one chapter justice. So we're going to focus on specific chapters, 2 and 7, and then if we have time, we're going to continue into 8. I think 2 and 7 are good because they show a correlation with each other. But we have a few more questions that are kind of a broader aspect. So we want to, let's talk about, who can tell us, you know, chapter 1, a little bit about chapter 1, a little bit about chapter 2, 3, 4 through 12 maybe. Who can get us, you know, what's in 1? Let's just talk about what's in chapter 1. What is chapter 1 about? Yes, Brother Darius.
The integrity of his character, which is the foundation of everything, because if it wasn't his character, which he proved to be faithful and obedient, he probably would not have the privilege of even knowing the insight into God's visions and all these things. So that, I would say, humility and integrity of his character.
Okay. Any other comments at all? You know, that's the beginning when they were taken captive, right at the beginning there. We're going to go back to chapter 1, and I think there's another couple important points there. But that's, I think that's hits right on the subject there. Anybody else want to make a comment on chapter 1 before we go to what's chapter? Oh, Brother David.
Yeah, well, yeah, I saw David.
Oh, go. I'm sorry.
It was written in chapter 1 was written in Hebrew. It's very important, I believe, to lay the foundation also. And along with what Brother Darius said, also to see the integrity of some of the others that were there, like, you know, his three friends that were there with him that were also of integrity. So I think they were laying a foundation of who God's people were with Daniel, you know, rising to be the spokesman of the day.
Okay. Brother David?
Well, as you mentioned, it recounts his captivity, so it's all very early in his experience. And you notice in chapter 1 and verse 12, there's this testing of Daniel and his three Hebrew friends for 10 days. Well, it kind of reminds me in Revelation, in one of the early churches at the beginning of the Gospel Age, there's a special tribulation of 10 days. And I think this is one of the links. I think when you go through Daniel, you're going to see symbols of all of the Revelation enemies of the church. There's the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet in Revelation. I think in chapter 1, you've got the dragon. There's the 10 days test, you know, you find in Revelation. And then chapter 2, you got the, well, I won't say too much. But
okay.
I think that's chapter 1.
Okay, we're gonna get to that also in chapter 1. I wanted to mention that, how we tie in some of maybe Revelation and the book of Daniel. So chapter 2, what's chapter 2 about? We're just doing kind of an overview here. Okay, testings. There was a dream, right? Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of an image. Let's just go on from there. There's an image. We'll get back to that one because we're going to focus in on number 2. So we don't have to expand on that too much now. What was chapter 3 about? Chapter 2 was the image that the stone that was cut out without hands smote it on the feet and it broke up. Okay, chapter 3. Okay, so there's the Hebrews that had the three Hebrews that had to bow down to the image out in the plain of, is it Dura or whatever? That image there. Okay, then what's the fourth chapter about? The tree? Okay, we got the tree dream there. So what we're trying to do is kind of, you know, make this so it's easy to kind of remember some of these things. They're broken up into chapters. They're all there, and I think it's really kind of easy to remember once we, you know, kind of talk about this. What's the fifth one? Okay, the many, many tekel upharsin, the writing on the wall. Okay, what's number 6?
Daniel in the lion's den.
Okay, Daniel in the lion's den. And I think it's kind of important, who's ruling at this time?
Darius,
okay. So it's the Medes and the Persians have taken over Babylon at this point. Okay, what's chapter 7 about? Okay, the history of the universe. Similar to chapter 2, right? chapter 7 and chapter 2, because these are the ones we're going to really go through. It's chapter 2 and chapter 7. We're going to hit on those. And what's chapter 8 about? The goat and the ram. Okay, those two. And does anybody have a feeling when these were, when chapter 8 was written compared to when the prophecy started to be fulfilled? I know there's one person in here that has. Brother Jim, do you have a... Yeah, but how many years before it actually was fulfilled? How many years he wrote the prophecy, and then how many years later was it actually fulfilled? Any just rough ideas?
Well, when the Persians took over, there you got the wrath. 10, 11 years.
Okay. And then chapter 9 is what's significant about chapter 9? When we read chapter 9, you know, what do we focus in on that one usually? 70 weeks travel. Our Lord's first advent, right? I mean, that's where we get the timing of our Lord's first advent, the only place. I think it's, you know, as I read through this and kind of thought about it, I was thinking, you know, when Daniel comes back in the kingdom, I think it's going to be a real moment for him to know that he was the one that was used to predict our Lord's first advent. You know, it's kind of to me I was kind of like, wow, just something to kind of ponder there for a minute and think about. I think that's... chapters 10, 11, and 12. What could we say about those? Brother David?
This is a long, protracted, detailed prophecy that takes you all the way from... Well, basically Daniel's day, or maybe a little later, all the way through to the kingdom of Christ. So it's a very comprehensive, that three chapters full of stuff.
Okay, so it's prophecy, history, that starts and it continues on. So I think that's important kind of to know that also. I mean, it's important for all this, but sometimes when you're reading through 10, 11, and 12, it can be a little confusing or whatever, but, you know, you kind of can string some of these together. Brother Jimmy, you had a comment or no?
I guess again.
Okay, there's a mic coming up your way.
Yeah, the detailed history is given in chapter 11 is so well fulfilled that the agnostics and modernists insist that Daniel couldn't have been written until much later, even to an absurdly late time, which would be ridiculous because... It was accepted by not only the Pharisees, but also by the Qumran community who hated the Pharisees.
Okay, thank you. Any additional comments at all? Now we want to talk about the history a little bit. I don't know if I'm going too fast or, you know, so anyway, if raise your hand or whatever if you have a comment or a question or a comment to make. Brother David brought up the captivity in chapter 1 was 10 days that they ate food. I think that's Daniel 1, verse 12. And maybe we can read that, Daniel 1, 12. And let's have... who would like to read that for us? Okay, Sister Margaret. Daniel 1, 12. And then maybe somebody else can look up Daniel or Revelation 2:10. Revelation 2:10. So okay. Daniel 1:12.
Yes. Please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink.
Okay, thank you. And then who has Revelation 2 verse 10? Sister Joanna, do you have that? Okay. I can see it in your eyes.
Fear none of these things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life.
Okay, thank you. So with that, you know, it's not conclusive, but I think the point I'm trying to make here is there's a pin or a starting point for this whole concept that we're going to start looking at. And we're going to get, I think, more into that concept a little bit here. So just, you know, keep some of these thoughts, and then we'll develop them a little bit more if there's some, you know, like, you know, maybe it's not real clear right now. So in the first one we have, well, when we talk about the dream of the image of the beast, what portion of history would that be when we talk about chapter 2? Nebuchadnezzar's image. Brother David?
Well, it starts way back with Babylon because it says, "Thou art the head of gold." So it's right in Nebuchadnezzar's day, and it goes all the way through to the kingdom of Christ. So it's a very comprehensive. It's not as detailed as chapter 11, for instance, but it's very comprehensive.
Okay, if we talked about the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, when we talk about the dragon, what aspect of government is that? Brother Jim?
The dragon is the tyrant, the corruption of God's attribute of power, and of course Satan is the being that's mentioned. But he is then the head of the Roman Empire at the time of the dragon.
Okay, which would be civil government, right, at that point? Satan's control over political dominion, I guess we could kind of say, in that aspect. So if we pin that with the Diocletian persecution, it kind of turns out to be the same thing. So that 10 days, the beginning of that, I just kind of wanted to make that correlation there. Then in chapter 2, we have the image of the beast, or the image, I should say. What portion of church history would that be? We have the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. So with those three, what would the image represent? What period of history would that one represent? Brother Jim?
There's more than one opinion on it, but I therefore will give my own. That I think the image of the beast is undoubtedly the Anglican church state, which was in the image of the papacy.
Okay, any additional comments at all? When we have Nebuchadnezzar's... Oh, Brother David, you had a comment? When we have Nebuchadnezzar's tree dream, it talks about seven times, right? That was that he was to be his madness was for seven times. What point in history would that bring us to? If we're talking about the seven times. 1914, I think. So here's the kind of the point I wanted to bring out here. Chapters 1, 2, and 3, and 4 kind of bring us to 1914. You start out with the civil power, the dragon. It goes into this image. I think you've got the Roman beast there, the church and state. And then I think you end up with Nebuchadnezzar's, the false prophet image, in there. And then the last one, I think, would be the seven times of madness, which would be civil power ending in 1914, the starting of the breaking down of the church-state union at that point. I think that's the start or the beginning of that system being broken up. Did anybody have any comments at all on that? Let's just talk about chapter 5, Belshazzar's feast. What would be that be a demise of? And we're looking at the type and the antitype, I guess. So when we look at that feast, what would that be the demise of? You've got this writing on the wall, right? Could we correlate that maybe to chapter 17 in Revelation? The demise of of papacy at that point. And then Daniel in the lion's den. How many of the the Medes and the Persians put Daniel in the lion's den? How many were there? Does anybody remember? Brother David?
I'm not sure what you're reaching for, but there were three presidents. Daniel was one, and the other two were his accusers. So in that respect, you would have two.
Okay. And so in that case, I'm thinking that's maybe the demise of the false prophet, the two-horned beast. That would be chapter 19. That's just, I'm just kind of making some comments and some thoughts here on how to tie some of this stuff in with some history. Brother Jim?
Chapter 6, verse 7, though, does say, all the presidents of the kingdom and the deputies and the satraps, the counselors and the governors have consulted together. So it sounds like maybe there were more than just the other two presidents.
Okay. I don't have my verse exactly that I had for that one.
Chapter 6, verse 7.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Brother David.
His two nearest competitors. There were three presidents, and two of them kind of really wanted to find occasion. But I think then all of them that kind of fell into line with this. But that might really enhance your point that in Revelation you've got the two-horned beast. But the two-horned beast is really the leader of a whole host. You know, it's kind of like in the Old Testament in the First Chronicles chapter 22, you had a two-horned leader. A leader of 400 false prophets. And I think that's the point, that the two-horned beast in Revelation is kind of a leader of many other people.
Okay. So I just wanted to kind of get the brethren kind of thinking from, chapter 1 through chapter 6. I think we see maybe the demise of the church in 6. That's probably something that hasn't happened yet. The Daniel and the lion's den in that aspect of it. Let's talk about the vision of the prophecy. The prophecy aspect. So the chapter 7 would be the vision of the four beasts, and then we'd have the ram and the goat. And 9 would be the vision of the 70 weeks, and then 10 through 12 would be the closing vision at that point. Let's see that. Here's another question I wanted to ask. Can we fully understand the Daniel without the book of Revelation? Okay, I see a head shaking. Can maybe one example that you can't understand one without the other. Does anybody have a good short maybe example?
1260 days.
That's exactly the one I have written down here. So maybe you could expound on that a little bit for us.
It would be probably a good one for me to be expounded on, because I think we can be in agreement with this one. Like Brother Jim so graciously said, there are different opinions based on our own personal studies and stuff. So I just wanted to say I appreciated Brother Jim's mentality there and gentleness. But the 1260 is one that I believe that we can all see with clarity of mind as the prophecy of the 42
months,
and how that correlates to the 1260 days. Now, I think from my personal standpoint of being appreciative of not understanding this prior to my becoming a Bible student is the actual being able to put it into a category of time and where that time begins, and then being able to see all the prophecies which correlate to what that is pointing to as being the Antichrist or the church period of persecution, the papal system, for that 1260 days, which started at 539, which was the historical conception, really, of the papal system coming into its own, whereas prior to, we see the history of how it built up with Constantine. But I think in my own personal appreciation from being able to be with a people that understands this concept and that we can agree with this particular concept, how it builds our confidence in how history and prophecy go together.
Okay. So in the book of Daniel, we've got times, time, and a half a time, right? So do we actually know what that represents? But in the book of Revelation, we have the 3.5 years, we have the 42 months, and we know that these prophecies are the same time period that they're talking about. So with the book of Revelation and looking at the book of Daniel, we can pretty much feel conclusive that in the book of Daniel, that time, times and a half a time represent the exact same amount of time. I think that's really the point here. Okay, any additional comments at all? Okay, continuing on with the book of Daniel and Revelation, who wrote the book of Revelation? John actually wrote it, right? Okay, so who does John represent? This was a point that Brother David made a little bit earlier, but I think this is really correlating these two. I think it kind of drives the point home. Who does John represent? Oh, Brother Jim?
God gave it to Jesus, and Jesus gave it to the church, so John would apparently represent the church.
Okay, and what aspect of the church does John represent? Where in the stream of time does John represent the church? I think this is really the more specific point that we want to get to.
Well, there's more than one opinion on it, but my thought would be throughout the gospel age.
Okay, throughout the gospel age, and we're going to talk about another opinion then. I think John represents maybe the harvest church, more specifically the harvest church. And actually, we're going to talk about that a little bit tomorrow. But just keep that in your mind. So then what does Daniel represent? Who does Daniel represent? Well, that answer was already given, but I think there's a correlation here, especially when you see the difference. Where does Daniel take us? He takes us to the 1335, right? He takes us to 1874. And so his vision is things that had proceeded prior to that. So who would Daniel represent? We talked about John representing the harvest church. Brother David?
I'm getting the flow of your thought that Daniel would picture the church up to the harvest. Well, that's very intriguing. It sounds quite credible to me. I hadn't distinguished it quite that way, but that sounds very intriguing. Your point about John being the harvest church stems like from the fact that John was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, turned behind him to see, you know, all the things. That all sounds credible. I hadn't actually seen it before.
Okay, so that was kind of my looking at the two. We've got, you know, Daniel representing. And so the whole point of this is when you look at Daniel and all the chapters there, we're looking at Daniel as being the entire, you know, it could be a picture of the gospel age. Any additional comments at all?
A question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because that's interesting, what's unfolding there. Now, if you put Daniel in that particular category as leading up to, then when God sent Gabriel to Daniel, how does Gabriel play into that as part of it? Like what Brother Jim so eloquently said, with God is the one that drove revelation through Jesus to John, which represents the church. So who would Gabriel be in the other context?
Okay, does anybody have a answer to that? I don't have a... that's something I think we can maybe put down in our notes and we can take a look at that. Does anybody have any thoughts on who Gabriel would represent? Okay, Brother David maybe?
Gabriel is the one that, of course, he gave the prophecy about our Lord's first advent. It couldn't be Michael because that was Jesus. That wouldn't be appropriate. And Gabriel is also the one that gave the prophecy of the 2300 days, which is like pre-second advent. So it looks like Gabriel is used to give the prophecy about the coming first advent and then like the approaching second advent. So it's kind of thematically, I don't know who Gabriel represents, but I think he's tied in with the pre-advent concepts.
Okay. So we can think on that a little bit and mull that over. How many prophecies are in the book of Daniel chapter 7 through 12? Remember we talked about the first six chapters being history and the second group of chapters, 7 through 12, being prophecy. How many prophecies are in the book of Daniel? Does anybody know how many prophecies there are? Okay, we've got chapter 7, right? The vision of the four beasts. So there's one there. Then chapter 8 would be another prophecy. That's the vision of the ram and the he-goat. And then we've got the 70-week prophecy in chapter 9. And then we've got the final prophecy in 10, 11, and 12. So there would be four prophecies in the book of Daniel.
I know
you still have that puzzled look, right? So we're gonna hopefully we can get into that in a minute, though. Okay, so let's continue on here. How many places in Revelation does John see from? Okay,
well,
brother.
Robin should be saying this because I learned it from him. But he says four venues. Am I right, Robin? Four venues, four locations that John has seen things from.
Okay, so let's just talk about those for a minute here. There's from Patmos, it's Revelation 1:10. He's looking backward. And, of course, you know, if you go forward on those chapters, you've got all the seven churches that he's seeing when he looks backward. Then Revelation 4:1, he's looking from heaven. And then Revelation 17, verse 3, he's in the wilderness. And then Revelation 21, verse 10, he's on a high mountain. It's the coming kingdom. He's looking at that coming kingdom. So I think there's maybe four prophecies in the book of Revelation. The question I have, does anybody know how these correlate with Daniel? Or is it just something that's intrinsic to both of these books? And I don't know, Brother Robin, did you ever expose or, you know, look at this a little deeper? No? Okay. I just thought I'd throw that kind of out there. I mean, like I said, there's going to be some fun facts that we're going to be able to write down, how they all fit together. Sometimes you don't know until some other things are opened up for you. Okay, why is chapter... Well, let's get to Brother Jim's question here. Why is chapter 2 historical? Why do I say chapter 2 is historical? Because it's an experience Daniel had. Okay? I mean, does that kind of satisfy? I mean, it's a prophetic vision, but it's an experience that Daniel had. What can we say about chapter 2 and Daniel's interpretation of the dream? And what could have happened to Daniel if he did not have, if he was not able to interpret this dream? Okay, he would have died at that point, right? Okay. He prayed to God and God gave him the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Did Nebuchadnezzar tell Daniel what the dream was? How far did this have to go? I mean, for Daniel to for this to be a real miracle. Can maybe somebody kind of explain a little bit for us? Okay, Brother Jim.
For a little bit of background, Nebuchadnezzar's past was as at the head of the military. And so often, as happens in government, the military doesn't trust the intelligence people. And so he gave the intelligence people something that they really couldn't do without a miracle from God. And it would have been an excuse for him to get rid of the people he didn't trust, those who might be trying to overthrow him.
Okay, so Daniel had to know what the dream was, and then he had to also tell what the interpretation of that dream was. So Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, but he never told anybody what it was. So there, you know, this is a real miracle. I mean, it's one thing to have somebody tell you what your dreams are after you tell them what, you know, what the interpretation of it is, after you tell them what the dream is, but Nebuchadnezzar never divulged what that dream was. So now let's go back to chapter 2. Let's all turn to chapter 2, and we kind of want to go through chapter 2, and then we're going to go to chapter 7, because there is a correlation there.
And as the brethren are turning there, since you gave me the mic.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think one of the another aspect that we really need to see here is also the character it took for Daniel to trust God and the courage to stand before someone that he was under authority to there to do what he did. And it correlates to us also. If we don't trust God, step out of our comfort zone, do the things that we have to do, be courageous in the face of whatever's going to happen. Just like the statement, dare to be a Daniel. I think this brings that out, what he's doing.
Okay, thank you. Who can give us an outline of chapter 2? There's that image, and what are the different metals that that image is made up of? Okay, Brother Jim.
The first three are monetary metals, and that's the gold, the silver, and the copper. And then the fourth one is iron, which was only a monetary metal in 1943, those iron pennies. But the first one and the third one are yellow metals.
Okay. And who can help us with the rest of the image? So what was the head made of?
Gold.
Okay. And who represented that head of gold? Nebuchadnezzar. And in Daniel 2:38 it says, "Thou art the head of gold," or "you are the head of gold," right? Okay. The arms and the chests were of what metal? Silver. And what empire does that represent? The Medes and the Persians, okay? And that could be representing the two arms, right? The Medes and the Persians, okay? And the thighs of brass. I should have asked what metal was the thighs, and that's brass. What did they represent? Greece. And then the feet, or the legs, were of what metal?
Iron.
And then what does that represent?
Rome,
okay. And then the feet were made of what? Iron and clay. And what does that represent? Something that's strong and something that maybe is weak. So, Brother Jim?
Cast iron is made up actually of both iron and clay, with the clay especially on the surface, but you get it from casting. But the iron, of course, is the strongest of those metals, but the clay is a mineral which makes it a good counterfeit of the stone.
Okay, and let's have somebody who has Daniel 2, 41 through 43 that they can read for us. Daniel chapter 2, 41 through 43. Who would like to read that? Okay. Brother Tim's going to read that for us.
In that you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron. Inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery.
Okay. So we would have that as being what Rome civil and ecclesiastical mixed together there. Brother Jimmy had a comment?
If you look at a map of, say, 18th century Europe, you get a real good picture of it. You've got a kingdom here ruled by a king, and you've got a principality ruled by a prince, and a duchy ruled by a duke, and so forth. And in between, you've got a bishopric, because its civil ruler was a bishop, and an archbishopric, and then an abbacy ruled by an abbot. And it was Voltaire that complained that in France, the crown owns one-third of the land, the church owns two-thirds, and the people own the rest.
Okay, who would like to read for us Daniel 2:34 through 34:35, and then 44 and 45? That talks about the stone that was cut out without hands, and we want to talk about that a little bit. That smites the image. Who would like to read that for us? Daniel 2:34 and 35. Okay, Sister Margaret.
So 34 and 35. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time, and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth.
And then, did you read verses 44 and 45? Yeah, please.
44 and 45. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy.
Okay, thank you. So what does that stone that was cut out without hands represent? The kingdom of Christ's kingdom, right? That's what that represents. Why does Daniel start with Babylon? Why, you know, we had the head of gold there, and you know, he says, thou art the head of gold. Why doesn't he start with the Egyptian kingdom or the Assyrian kingdom that was prior to Babylon? Why doesn't he start with those kingdoms? What's important about Babylon? We talked about Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and we talked about Rome. We talked about those four. Why does he start there? Why doesn't he start somewhere else? Sister Margaret?
I'm not an expert, but I'm just assuming that in Babylon, that's where the counterfeit started. That's where the clay and the iron started to mix. And that's when corruption started to enter. And also, Daniel's life starts out when they're discussing Babylon, when he's taken into Babylon.
Okay. Any additional comments? Who did... Oh, yes. Brother Rick. And the, oh, you, okay.
This is where the history transitions from the kingdom of Israel, which was rejected. Babylon was the one who exercised the punishment. And the favor goes to the Babylon. It becomes the golden cup. And the power is transferred to consecutive empires, universal empires. So from Israel, it goes to Babylon. It never went to Egypt.
Okay. So it's all the powers that were over Israel. That's I think, the key to this. And I'll just make a side point here. You know, when you look at Revelation 17, those kings are the ones that ruled over Rome. I think there's another distinction there, but this really isn't a Revelation study. But just one of the key things that I kind of keep in my mind, one is Rome. This one here, Daniel, would be those that ruled over Israel. And then, Rick, did you have a comment? Same thing? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. This is the last time Israel will have a king until the one who's going to follow in David's footsteps will show up. So if there is no king in Israel, there is no kingdom. So it's the end of the Israel as a kingdom until a future date.
Okay. And, you know, when I look at it, I kind of look at it, the distinction between Jews and Gentiles. The Gentile rule was over Israel. And then we have, you know, we're living in the days when Israel is ruling over Israel today. So, you know, we're entering into this phase, I think. 1914, things are collapsing, starting, and then Christ's kingdom is starting to be set up at that point. So just kind of give you an idea or a picture of where we are in the stream of time here. Now let's all turn to chapter 7. And let's talk about chapter 7 a little bit. What is the correspondence between chapter 2 and chapter 7? Chapter 2, whose dream was that? Nebuchadnezzar's dream, right? Chapter 7, whose dream is that? Daniel's dream. Okay, so now we've got Nebuchadnezzar and we've got Daniel. Who does Nebuchadnezzar sees this image. It's a beautiful image, right? A head of gold and silver and brass, and this is a great image. Now when we go to chapter 7, what do we see there? Oh, Brother Darius.
We see the beasts which were formed by the wind out of the sea. The masses of people directed by different type of ideology brought up different structures, different beasts which turned away around and were destroying the people. So this is really when the kingdom which the Lord set up in Israel to be a figurative kingdom is destroyed, then people take over, so to speak, and this is what they bring up on themselves.
Okay, so if Daniel, and this is kind of like a little deviation from what we were talking about earlier, because that was the big picture, who Daniel represented, but in this picture here, Daniel in chapter 7, you know, he would be more of, this would be God's point of view. He would represent God in this thing, in this vision. And this would be God's point of view, that these kingdoms really are beasts. They're ugly. They're not very nice, you know, governments. But in Daniel's, or in Nebuchadnezzar's view, this is from man's point of view. Oh, these are beautiful kingdoms. These are nice kingdoms. Look how great this is. We have this head of gold and this arms of silver and, you know, brass and whatever. This is, you know, from man's point of view, it's really not that bad. But from God's point of view, he's really telling you what these kingdoms are. Brother Darius?
Because you like to tie it up to Revelation. Revelation ends up with the situation when there is no more sea. There's no more people who can be blown by any type of wind. And you know, it's interesting that the water will always conform to the vessel in which you have it, right? So it blows from this way, it will go this way. But Revelation ends up, there's no more sea in this sense. People cannot be blown with any type of wind or teaching.
Okay. Thank you. Who can give us an outline of chapter 7? We talked about chapter 2. You know, there's the four parts that it's broken up into. Who can give us a little outline of chapter 7? Let's all turn to chapter 7, in fact. What was the first beast there that's talked about in chapter 7? Brother Jim?
The first beast is a lion, followed by a bear, followed by a leopard, followed by the indescribable beast, which, in my opinion, is the same as the dragon in Revelation. And we note again, beast number 1, the lion, is a yellow beast, and beast number 3, a leopard, is a yellow beast, corresponding to the yellow metals number 1 and 3 in Nebuchadnezzar's image.
Okay, thank you. I'm writing that down because that's a point I never connected that before, so I thank you, appreciate that. The color of the metals and the colors of the beasts. Okay, thank you. So the first one is the lion. What does the lion represent? You know, we're correlating this now with Daniel, the second chapter. Has anybody been to the Chicago Institute of... they have part of the Walls of Babylon there and one of the museums. Which one is it? Is it the Science Museum? Anyway, they got part of the Walls of Babylon there. Does anybody know what's on that wall? It's a lion, right? Okay, so there's a picture of a lion there, and that. So it has, and it talks about in Daniel 7:4. Maybe somebody can read that verse for us. Daniel 7:4. You want to read that for us? Yes? No? Okay.
Daniel 7:4. The first was like a lion that had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and as a man's heart was given to it.
Okay, and what does that represent, a man's heart was given to it? Does anybody have any thoughts about a man's heart? What does the heart represent? Okay, maybe the mind, right? It was kind of thinking of the mind. I mean, we talk about the brain, you know, but I think in the scriptures, the heart would be maybe the mind or whatever. So could we say Babylon was the beginnings of maybe man starting to think about sciences and different things like that? Brother Jim?
They wouldn't have been the first ones to be thinking about sciences necessarily, but one other possibility, and I'm not strong on it, is that at the time of Nebuchadnezzar's 7 years of craziness, he came back and there was a bit of a heart of the empire when he recognized the God of heaven.
Oh, okay. Okay. Came to his senses. Okay. Good. Any additional comments? It talks about the bear in Daniel 7, verse 5. Maybe somebody can read that for us.
On point, you were just saying...
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, a while ago you were like looking for a particular statement about the lion, which is lion is the king of beasts. Just a little side note. There was a little conversation in Africa not too long ago about... What is the most dangerous animal in Africa? Most of the kids, you know, said, you know, the lion. But then the man that was trying to teach them the lesson said, no, it's the mosquito. I think that is a lesson too, but...
Okay, from malaria. Okay. So let's read Daniel 7, verse 5.
And behold, another beast, a second,
like to a bear, and it raised it up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh.
Okay, so what would the bear represent? What kingdom does that one represent? The Medo-Persia. When it talks about it's being raised up on one side like this, you know, one shoulder being higher, what would that represent? Today, who do we know? The Medes or the Persians? Persians. We don't know the Medes anymore, do we? I mean, there are people somewhere, but they're not really prominent, right? They've mixed in with others. But the Persians, we know. Yeah, Iran. We know who the Persians are. So I think that, you know, to me, that kind of shows the prominence. Also with, maybe we'll get to that in chapter 8, a similar type of thought. And then what was the third one, the third beast?
Leopard.
Okay, the leopard. And what was distinct about this leopard? What was really different about this leopard? Okay, four wings, and it had four something else.
Four heads.
Four heads. Okay, so who wants to read for us Daniel 7, 6? Daniel 7, 6. Yes.
After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it.
Okay, and what would those four heads represent? Maybe what would that leopard represent, and then what the four heads represent? So we have, you know, Babylon. We talked about Medo-Persia. This is the third one. What does the third one represent?
Greece.
Okay, Greece. And then what would those four heads represent? Okay, so they're the divisions after Alexander dies. Those are the divisions of his empire at that point. Brother Jim, did you have an additional comment?
Yeah, just in the history of it, after Alexander suddenly died as a young man, that his son and his feeble-minded half-brother were both murdered, and the general Antigonus tried to hold the empire together. And then we had Ptolemy took over Egypt, and Seleucus took over Syria, Cassander took over Macedonia, and Lysimachus took over Thrace.
Okay. So that gives us an outline right there of what the four were. I think that's part of my notes here, but that's if we get back to it, we'll get back to that. Who has Daniel? Does anybody else have any other comments on the four heads of the leopard? Yes.
I just wanted, you know, how you brought out the Medes and Persians, the two arms. Well, the thigh has four major muscle groups.
Oh. Okay. Thank you. So who wants to read for us Daniel 7, 7? Okay, thanks.
After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. And it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns.
Okay, thank you. So what kind of teeth did this beast have?
Iron.
And what does that remind us of back in Daniel 2? This goes right along with some of Brother Jim's comments about the similar metals again, which I never kind of looked at the colors, but, you know, here now we've got some similar metals. So, Brother Jim, you had the comment on that? What does the iron
It represent the same as the iron, the number four metal in the image, or the Roman Empire. And now we have something interesting here, that we have one beast with four heads, three beasts that just one apiece. None of the animals here has horns except the last one. So collectively, these four beasts have seven heads and ten horns, which reminds us of Revelation.
Okay, thank you. And there's a couple different thoughts on that too, but that's one of them, right, Brother Jim? Okay. What else can we say about this this beast? It had ten horns, and in Daniel, the second chapter, the image has how many toes? Ten toes, okay. So what does the ten represent? What does that ten represent? Would we say those are the Germanic tribes that spread over Europe, the ten tribes? Sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less. Okay, Brother Jim's got his chart with all the coins on it. And so that goes right along with this, the same concept here. Yeah, Brother David?
Well, one thing I appreciate about Jim's studies on this is that he points out that there are exactly ten that can be identified as wearing the diadem. And I always thought that was quite intriguing. I don't remember the names of them, but I'm partial to thinking that that might identify precisely ten. As you say, through history, of course, different nations, you know, numbered more or less. But that would give a kind of a precision to the prophecy.
Okay. And then who would like to read for us Daniel 7, verse 8? Daniel 7, verse 8. Okay, Brother Richard.
And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things.
Okay, so what would this represent? Who would help us with an explanation of this little horn that comes up and it starts speaking? Brother Jim?
I know I'm doing too much talking, but we start out with ten horns. Little horn comes up making 11. And the second phase of the Roman Empire was that of the Papal Rome. And three horns are plucked up from before it. That we had, I think it was the initially the Heruli, and then the Ostrogoths, and then the Lombards were swallowed up into the Kingdom of Italy.
Okay. Any additional comments on that? You know, the outline for chapter 7, it's kind of interesting. You have the initial vision, which is verses 1 through 14, chapter 7, 1 through 14. And then verses 15 and 16, Daniel requests more understanding. And then there's an interpretation in 17 and 18, additional interpretation. And then in Daniel 7, 19 and 20, through 22, Daniel has a second request for more understanding. And then in the rest of the chapters, verses 23 through 28 is the additional explanation. And I think it's kind of interesting to kind of see, you know, here's a vision. Daniel asks for interpretation. He gets it. Then he asks for more. And you know, so there's, and we see this again, I think, in additional chapters in Daniel of information given. And him asking for additional information on what this represents. So let's turn. Anything else anybody wanted to talk about on chapter 7? There's a correlation between chapter 2 and chapter 7, and that was really one of the main points I wanted to bring home here. So, you know, that really is the. If you take anything home, there's a correlation between 2 and 7. And that's really, you know, and what the perspective is on each one of those. Now let's go over to chapter 8. And who can give us an outline of chapter 8 and what chapter 8 is about, or just give us an outline of what chapter 8 is. And we have just a couple minutes to talk about this too. I can do, you know, maybe I should just say chapter 8 is about a ram and a goat, and that's Daniel 8:21, and the ram represents the Medes and the Persians, and the goat represents the Grecian Empire. The ram has two horns, and what do they represent? The Medes and the Persians. And one horn is what? It's higher. It's the same kind of thing again. I think, you know, with the bear, you know, one of his shoulders was higher. So here you have one horn that's higher, and I think it's the prominent one that takes over. We don't really know too much about the Medes today, but the Persians, Iranians, you know, we know about them. I mean, they're still around. So I think that's, to me, that's kind of what that represents. Daniel 8:3, the ram with two horns, one longer than the... Okay, I said that. What empire is missing out of Daniel 8?
Babylon.
And why is that missing?
I think just starting the next one and ready to go forward.
Yeah, I think that one's done. You know, it's on its way out. And then Daniel 8:4, it talks about the direction. Maybe we could just read that since we're really running out of time here. Who wants to read Daniel 8:4 for us? Yeah, go ahead, Sister Margaret.
I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself.
Okay, how many, you know, history's a little foggy on this, but the Medes and the Persians had, how big was their army?
2 million.
2 million? Okay, I've heard 5 million. It's a lot, though. I mean, this is a force that's unprecedented in history. You know, just massive amounts of people that are in this army that go. So they go eastward. They go in a number of directions here. Let's just talk about the three. So it goes toward the west, which would be Babylon, right? It takes over Babylon. Northward would be, we should have a map here, but you can look at your Bible map. That would be Lydia. And southward would be what? What was south? Egypt, right? Those are the directions that I have for those. And so with that, the goat, you know, would represent, that had the long one horn, that would represent Alexander the Great. That's Daniel 8:21, and that was divided into the four empires. And I think at this point maybe we have to stop here. That gives us an outline of, actually I'm glad we got through some of chapter 8, but chapters 2 and 7 I thought were the important ones to see the correlation. Did anybody have any closing comments they wanted to make? Brother Jim?
Just offer the suggestion about out of one of these horns that I think not all do, that that horn is actually the horn of Thrace, because they were the ones who built up Rome. You have this story about Romulus and Remus were suckled by a wolf, and the wolf was the animal that depicted Thrace.
Okay. With that, yes, in the back.
Interesting that Brother Jim brought up that the iron didn't become a monetary value until 1943, whereas we know that 1943 was a very tumultuous time in this earth because of war, and iron is a metal of war. So I think that correlates very well.
Okay, thank you. And if there aren't any additional comments, I think we'll kind of just close here. I appreciate all the brethren's comments and their participation. And I hope this kind of gave you a little bit of an outline for the book of Daniel. It gave you some nice things to think about. And when you go deeper into the book of Daniel and you think about these things, maybe you'll, be able to put some more of this together for us. So with and we'll turn the meeting back over to Brother David.
Well, thank you, Brother Bill. Very, very intriguing. Some points I hadn't gathered before, and I appreciate being enlightened by them. The next item on your program is a dinner, and I think Sister Kleppen has been working. Sister Marilyn, I'm sorry, but Sister Marilyn has been working away, and I guess it'll be in the second room up. Is that correct? Second room up. Okay. The bill will close with prayer and ask the Lord to bless our fellowship and evening meal.
Dear Father in heaven, we come before Thee now at this time, giving thanks for this day and for the opportunity that we've had to meet together with ones of like precious faith and discuss a portion of Thy Word. And we ask that anything that we discuss this evening would be in accordance with Thy plans and purposes, and overrule anything that maybe was said that wasn't in line with Thy Word. And now we ask, Father, that Thou would bless the food that has been prepared for us, the meal, so that we can continue to do what Thy will is. And we also ask that Thou would bless our fellowship that would be uplifting one to another. And we thank Thee for all these blessings that Thou has given us today. And we thank Thee and ask this all in Jesus' most holy and precious name. Amen.